Your support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants, since 1985 offering discerning patients a solution for failed root canal treated teeth. Information is available online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. At the British Open, Tiger Woods was two shots better yesterday than he was the day before that. If he improves by two more shots today, and by two more than that tomorrow, we'll all say we knew all along that it would happen just that way, or that we should have, and he'll have to win just one more tournament for the Grand Slam. Joining us now from the Muirfield Golf Links in Gillain, Scotland, site of the British Open, is the Globe and Mail's Lorne Rubenstein. Lorne, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thanks, Bill. Nice to chat with you.
And I guess I shouldn't have said British Open because the British prefer for the tournament to be called simply the Open, right?
That's right. If anybody is listening to the show on the web from over here in Scotland, you may get a few emails from them.
Tiger Woods was the story of the Open before play began. Many, if not most, if not all, expected Woods to win the third leg of the Grand Slam. Should Woods fans worry now that so many golfers were at least even with Tiger at the halfway point?
I don't think so. If anybody has studied Tiger's performance over the majors he's won, he seems to do just about exactly what he's done in the first two rounds, which is just make a bit of a move, hang around, not make a lot of putts, but be right there within a few shots of the lead, and then make his move somewhere on Saturday, usually on the back nine, and suddenly Sunday morning starts, and there he is, leading or tied or one off the lead. That's except for, of course, when he goes out and wins a U.S. Open by 15 shots or the Masters by 8 shots. But he can win anyway, and no, I don't think there's cause for worry quite yet.
All right, let's get away from Tiger for a moment, unpopular as that strategy may be. If he doesn't win the tournament, who among the many crowded at the top of the leaderboard has the best shot?
Well, everybody has been saying this week that Muirfield is a golf course that a lot of players, including some of these 40-somethings, can hang in there and play pretty well because the emphasis isn't on length, it's on shot-making and strategy. So I think it's very possible that you'll see somebody like Nick Price, who's a former Open winner in 1994, do well. He's at 4-under par starting the weekend, and certainly he's right there. Ernie Els, of course, who yesterday went out and shot 29 on the front nine, phenomenal, but came back in 37. He's right there. Montgomery, who shot 64 yesterday. And so I think there are a number of players who can challenge it, but I'd be surprised to see any but the top players really there in the end tomorrow.
Maybe I was reading the wrong stuff before the tournament, but I read a lot of speculation that Muirfield was really going to beat up the players, and that hasn't happened. Why not?
Well, I suppose you could look at it and say it hasn't beat up the players because after a couple of rounds, there are a lot of players under par. I mean, the cut was only, if you're within 7 or 8 shots of the lead, you've made the cut. So that's pretty good. But on the other hand, nobody has gone out there and shot a pair of 64s. If you look at the PGA Tour where they do that regularly, they're 15, 16 under par after two rounds. That didn't happen at Muirfield. And so while it hasn't beaten up on the players, neither have they beaten up on it. The best so far. Every time a player made a move in the first 2 days, Ernie Els shooting that 29, something else happened. They came back to the field. Sure, Monty shot 64 yesterday. Conditions were ideal. And the golf course, as I'm sure you know, links golf depends entirely on the weather. And the wind didn't blow at all the first 2 days. I hope it will on the weekend.
Oh, now you've got to follow up on that. Why would anybody hope that the wind would blow? It's not the real thing unless they're really being hampered out there by the elements?
In a sense, that's true. Lynx golf is made for the wind. I mean, it's all seaside golf, and so you want the wind to blow, so the players have to adopt even more of a strategy. They have to bounce the ball in. They can't just throw it up into these greens that have gotten so soft or relatively soft because of the rains here in the last little while, including on the Thursday and Friday this week. So, yeah, you do want it to blow. You do want these guys to be tested. You want them to have to hit a variety of shots. That, I suppose, is only going to help the quality players, sure, but that's the way a Lynx should play. And I think a major championship, you want to test them mentally as well as you do just their golf swing, and the wind helps that.
Lorne, you have written not only articles but a book, which is in part about the experience of playing on courses like Muirfield. Besides the weather, what distinguishes a course like that from the course that we've seen on TV where, the PGA players generally play here at home?
Well, when people back home in North America watch the Open this weekend, they will see a golf course that on the surface or on the screen doesn't look all that exciting. It doesn't look that dramatic. It looks pretty flat. They won't see any water hazards, really. It doesn't look all that interesting. It's not pretty. It's not beautiful. There aren't waterfalls all over the place. There's a certain strictness about these golf courses, a certain severity, and that comes really from the nature of the ground, the fact that there's lumps and bumps and the ball will bounce when it's dry enough. You can see all kinds of tees and greens from all over the course. It's open. It's right near the sea, which defines a links. And so all of those qualities add to the atmosphere of an Open Championship as well. And when you play at an Open Championship, you're playing on a golf course that's often right at the edge of a village. And here in Gillen, there are all sorts of golf courses right around, and everybody speaks about golf. It's very much part of the culture here.
All of these qualities of a course like Muirfield notwithstanding, many people think that if they played the Open in the Sahara Desert or they played on the tarmac at Logan Airport, it wouldn't matter. Tiger would win anyway, right?
Well, they do, and there's no question. And the players know that if Tiger plays his best game, then a chance are that he's going to win because he's just got more talent than every player out here. But so they have to beat him in another way or perhaps hope he doesn't play on top of his game. But, you know, he's shown a little bit of frustration in the first two rounds. He's gotten upset a few times. And so I don't know. You know, maybe he's a bit on edge right now, and who knows. I think there are a lot of good players up there, and I'm not handing this one to Tiger by any means. On the other hand, he's shot 138 the first two rounds, and he hasn't even looked like he's broken stride yet. That's the thing. He shoots 400 par, 138, and it looks like he's shooting 80 each round.
Lauren Rubenstein covers golf for the Globe and Mail. He is the author of A Season in Dornoch. Lauren, thank you for joining us once again, and I hope you see a smashing finish.
Okay, thanks, Bill. Take care.
Straight down the middle. It went straight down the middle. Then it started to hook just a wee bit. That's when my caddy lost sight of it. That little white pellet has never been found to this day. But it went straight down the middle, like they say. Whack down the fairway, it went smack down the fairway. Then it started to slice just a smidge offline. It headed for two, but it bounced off nine. My caddy said, long as it's still in the state, you're okay. Yes, it went straight.
Today in San Jose, Major League Soccer's top two teams will battle each other for first place in the Western Conference and the league lead in points. The San Jose Earthquakes, led by Landon Donovan, currently sit in first place. From San Jose, Jason Margolis has this report on the Quakes.
Today's game doesn't quite have the tension you might expect when the league's two best teams get together. There's no feeling of a midsummer classic afoot between, say, the Yankees and the Red Sox. After all, 8 of the league's 10 teams will qualify for the playoffs. So besides bragging rights and home field advantage in the postseason, the regular season doesn't hold too much drama. But San Jose Earthquakes coach Frank Yallop says today's matchup is a showcase of North America's best soccer. And the league is riding a wave of enthusiasm spilling over from the World Cup.
Yeah, we've seen the fan awareness and attendances go way up for us, so we're all happy on that front. I think overall, you look at every MLS team and all their attendances went up.
For nearly 2 months, the San Jose Earthquakes were without their two-star players, forward Landon Donovan and defender Jeff Agus, who were with the U.S. national team in Korea. Second place Dallas didn't lose any players to the World Cup. Even with the two San Jose stars away, the Earthquakes held on to first place. The two players returning only makes the team that much stronger, says Coach Yallop, even though they're a little roughed up.
Obviously getting those two guys back, just the names themselves, and to have them back in your squad feels great. They had a wonderful World Cup, both the players. And, you know, Jeff's come back injured and Landon's probably come back a little bit tired because of all the stuff he's doing for not only obviously himself, but for the sport in this country. He's been on a bit of a whirlwind tour of duty, if you like, with the press and show TV shows and stuff.
Since the World Cup, 20-year-old Landon Donovan has become one of North America's most recognizable soccer figures. After scoring 2 goals in Korea and helping the U.S. squad advance to the quarterfinals, Donovan hit the talk show circuit, appearing on Letterman, Regis and Kelly, and the Today Show, to name a few. And after playing in packed stadiums with rabid fans in Korea, he says he was a little concerned about an emotional letdown upon returning home. But he says he's keeping things in perspective.
People sometimes forget that a smaller crowd doesn't mean a worse crowd. And especially at Spartan Stadium, where we play, even 10, 12,000 people can sound or feel like 70,000. So generally, everywhere we've been, there's been a good atmosphere. I think people are more excited now and more into it, so it's good.
Donovan played in Germany as a teenager, and he's actually under contract with the German club team Bayer Leverkusen, located near Cologne. Technically, he's on loan to Major League Soccer for 2 years, this being the second year. Despite the potential for more exposure and a bigger paycheck if he returns to Europe, Donovan says he wants to stay in the United States.
It's familiar to me, the language. Soccer is starting to take off in America. I want to be part of it. All the right things are in place.
Well, his speed and uncanny ability to finish a play make him popular with soccer devotees, Donovan is experiencing another type of stardom as well. Recently, he was named AOL's Crush of the Month.
It's all fake. I didn't really get picked. I just paid my way in. No, it's cool. It's awesome. Maybe I'll have some 15-year-old girls screaming for me. Who knows?
There's no question that Donovan is giving Major League Soccer a shot in the arm. But the world's most popular sport still has a lot of catching up to do in America. Michelle Smith covers the earthquakes for the San Francisco Chronicle. She says there are still many obstacles to overcome before the average sports fan embraces soccer.
You know, the sports that are big here in the U.S. are television sports very often. And it doesn't televise well in the sense that there aren't any breaks in the action.
Soccer's continuous flow means ESPN can't cut away even for a few seconds for a commercial. And in America, no advertisements means no coverage. ESPN2 will air just 11 regular season games this season. So while Dallas and San Jose are playing for first place today, don't bother flipping through your channels unless you're in town. It's not on TV. For Only a Game, I'm Jason Margolis in San Jose.
It's 18 minutes past the hour. Followers of U.S. pro sports wear bold tattoos and facial hair sprawl over the epidermal landscape without censure may be surprised to learn that it is not everywhere so. This week, 6 Japanese high school students were ejected from a judo tournament because, quote, they shaved their eyebrows to a fashionable but intimidating thin line. Apparently, the eyebrow shaving is a fad among teenagers in Japan, but that cut no ice with tournament organizer Tatsuo Kakazaki, who said, "We have banned thin eyebrows because they are intimidating to opponents and cause displeasure."
Well, I'm mean, and I'm bad, 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 but I'm the best damn bunkie that you ever had. I shave with a chainsaw. Ain't you glad I'm on your side?
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. To read more about Tiger Woods' quest to win golf's Grand Slam and to read about others joining him on the leaderboard, log on to our website, WBUR.org, and click on News. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Direct Tire and Auto Service in Watertown, Norwood, Peabody, and Natick. Repairing cars, vans, and SUVs since 1974. Online at directtire.com. In the forecast, clouds breaking for sun. It will be pleasant today. Highs around 78 degrees. Clear skies tonight. Overnight lows around 60 in the outlying areas. 65 in Boston. For tomorrow, sunny to partly cloudy. Humid highs around 82. And in the 70s near the water. Monday will be hazy sun. Hot, more humid. Highs near 90 degrees. 64 degrees in Boston at 720.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, the author of a new book on the beautiful game in Brazil tells great stories. But first, a little later on today, after a week of soccer action, the USA Cup will conclude. The world's largest youth soccer tournament held at a single location covers 50 soccer fields and brings in teams of both genders from around the nation and around the globe. From Blaine, Minnesota, Mary Stuckey has this report.
16,000 athletes march into the National Sports Center Stadium behind flags representing 36 states and 19 different countries for the opening ceremonies of the USA Cup. According to Scott Clayson, a tournament organizer, it's more than this event's size. that makes it special.
You're marinating in soccer for the week, and you walk down our main plaza of the National Sports Center, and you hear five different languages in the course of 100 yards. You get to see the Latin style of play on one field. Then you walk 200 yards over to the other fields, and you see the European style, the German style of play. It's amazing when you see some of these like under 12 boys teams from England. It's like it almost looks like little midgets playing the game because they're so good with the ball.
Scotty, you got to get there. Well done, Brady Moore.
Good job, Brady.
A lot of these kids have watched the different national styles on television, but it's not the same as facing those styles on the field, according to Adam Reed from Columbia, Missouri.
Well, like, if you play a team from, like, South Africa, they're, like, play a lot faster and, like, kind of, like, more, I don't know, more aggressive game than, like, some other team from, like, England or something.
It's not just the kids who need to adjust. Minnesota referee Paul Gincola says the variation in national styles even carries over to the rules of the game.
Well, some of them, it's like you talk to some of these people, no blood, no foul is what the British say. You know, so unless you really cream the guy out, you know, they're not going to blow the whistle. They want to keep it playing, keep it moving, you know.
The international flavor of this sport attracts kids and adults alike, according to the tournament's Scott Clayson, who loves the way in which soccer breaks down barriers between people.
These teams that come in from, say, Mexico or Brazil, they don't speak any English. These are 12-year-old boys. Well, all of a sudden, they start kicking a ball around. They're playing a game, and they're having fun. And all of a sudden, a rapport is starting between these kids that has no words need to pass back and forth. Again, it is that bond of sports.
That bond carries over to life off the field. Many of the kids who come from abroad stay with Minnesota families. Over the years, Luann Wingard and her family, potato farmers who live in Elk River, Minnesota, have hosted kids from Iceland, Germany, Slovakia, Mexico, Bermuda, and England.
I just wanted to give that to my children, to let them know that there's something else out there, you know, and the way we live isn't necessarily that the rest of the world, the way the rest of the world lives.
In fact, the Wingards have become close friends with the first soccer player they hosted from Mexico. Just last year, Pedro Ayora was the best man in Mark Wingard's wedding. The boys met when they were just 14 years old. Now Pedro's going to college in Minnesota, all because of a soccer tournament.
And I thank very much this tournament because, in a way, it unite two nations and people and friends. It's bigger than soccer. I mean, soccer united us. In the first place, but then, I mean, we got to know each other, and I mean, it was more than soccer, for sure.
Even Americans have something to learn from each other about breaking stereotypes. Girls on a team from Alaska want to set the record straight.
We're from Fairbanks, and we don't ride polar bears to school like everyone thinks.
Yeah, and we don't live in igloos.
It may seem extravagant to send teens across the country or even the world to play soccer, but Diane Stanky says it's worth it. She's a soccer mom from Mount Prospect, Illinois.
This is kind of the end of their season, and a lot of the kids are going on to high school. So this is something I think they're going to remember for the rest of their lives, being with teams from all over the world.
Bringing kids from all over the world can be expensive. Each player on a team from Scotland had to raise about $1,000. Now that they're here, Coach Jim Smith says his team is pumped up to win.
We've been here once before with another Scottish team, and they got to the quarterfinals. But the main thing is that they enjoy it. Sure, if they win the tournament, that's a real bonus.
The Scots aren't the only team to fundraise to come to the tournament. 16-year-old Emma Brunt from Sweden says her team saved money for more than a year so they could reconnect with their American soccer friends.
Last summer, there was girls who was visit us in Sweden, American girls, and this summer we should visit them.
And so the teams are finding out just how much they have in common. In fact, when asked why they're here, many of the boys give the same answer.
Girls, yeah, lots of girls.
Lots of girls.
Soccer is too fun. First girls, you know.
It's a lot of fun because you play teams from all over. And
you meet a lot of girls.
For Only Game, I'm Mary Stuckey in Blaine, Minnesota.
Earlier this summer, Brazil outclassed Germany 2-0 to win the 2002 World Cup. Brazil has won soccer's top prize 5 times. No other team has won more than 3 cups. Alex Bello's new book, Football, Soccer the Brazilian Way, goes some distance toward explaining that circumstance, and it takes on various other fascinating matters as well. Alex Bello joins me now from NPR's New York Bureau. Alex, welcome to Only a Game.
Hi, good to be here.
Historically, football or soccer has meant a great deal to Brazilians at all levels of society. Back in 1938, well before Brazil had won its first World Cup, the poet Gilca Machado wrote, quote, "The soul of Brazil lays down a kiss on your heroic feet." How did it come to be so?
It's long and sort of complicated. I think Brazil is a very young country. It was only in 1889 that that became a republic. It imported more slaves than anywhere else. And it was really searching for an identity. And 3 years after it became a republic, football arrived. And all of a sudden, it became incredibly popular. And it was one of the only things that really brought the nation together. And in fact, people say, what came first, Brazil loving football or Brazil being very good at football? And I think Brazil had established that football was its main sport 20, 30 years before it actually became best of the world. And I think that football was so important to Brazilians that they had to be best in the world. And it took them about 20, 30 years. And once they were, they've been there ever since.
Early in your book, you write about several Brazilian players who were plying their trade in some extraordinarily unlikely places. The Faroe Islands between Scotland and Iceland, for example. Soccer players have become one of Brazil's top exports, I gather, and some of them must feel weirdly displaced.
Completely. I went to the Faroe Islands, which, as you say, it's an archipelago of about 40,000 people belonging to Denmark, but much nearer Iceland. And even if a British or American person living there would find it hard to adapt, but these are Brazilians who only know a lifestyle of sort of beach and beers and of sort of kicking a ball around streets, and they're in places where you can't go out because it's too cold and it's too windy. They don't speak the language. It's absolutely sort of hilarious, really. And the reason why I went there was to show the fact that Brazil supposedly reached the best ever soccer team of all time is generally regarded as the 1970 World Cup side, the Brazil side with Pelé that won it. And even though they've never quite played that well again, the myth of Brazilian soccer is so strong that you can really sell a Brazilian wherever you want in the world just by nature of being Brazilian that you think that they're going to be better. And in fact, when in the Faroe Islands, 6 players went there, and one of them was so bad that he couldn't even get in the team. But that didn't matter because he brings the image of happiness and of fun and of friendliness. So people are very happy to have them. They see that everyone is sort of touched by the magic of Pelé, even, you know, 32 years after and 10,000 miles away.
You write that Brazil's football players are, I'm quoting here, usually shockingly underprivileged and uneducated, and the player named Garrincha would seem to qualify. He, you say, and not Pelé, is perhaps the most adored player in the history of Brazilian football.
Yeah, and that surprised me, and that was why I sort of chose to tackle this subject. I mean, I arrived in Brazil 4 years ago, and when I was learning the language, one of the first things you start to talk about in bars and just to friends is soccer. And very quickly, people were saying, Garrincha, Garrincha, and I was like, who's this guy? Because in England, I just never heard of him. I was saying, well, no, I know who the best player is, it's Pelé. And then they're saying, no, Pelé. Pelé is like your hero. Pelé is like a world hero. He's not a Brazilian thing. And I'm saying, well, why? And say, well, Pelé, you know, after he retired, he became a politician. You know, he made all this money. You know, he's a black guy. He just married white women. You know, he doesn't represent anything. Whereas Garrincha was this wonderfully sort of happy-go-lucky, very sort of amateur in spirit. He was the guy who just dribbled all over the place. He would even dribble in front of the goal, but instead of scoring, he dribbles some more plays and then go and score. So he was incredibly irresponsible. But he made the fans laugh. And when he retired, he was also exploited by the country and the game. He lost all his money. He became an alcoholic and he died 20 years ago when he was aged in his mid-40s. And so I think there's an incredible guilt that people feel about him. And also, you know, he died young and no one's around to tarnish the myth, whereas every day Pelé does something or says something in Brazil and he tarnishes the myth. You know, people aren't living with Pelé, the great player, which is what everyone in the world is. They're living with Pelé, you know, the guy who's constantly doing deals, allegations of corruption, he's making huge amounts of money, And that doesn't go down that well in Brazil. And definitely, Garrincha is the player that they love. You know, they respect Pelé, of course, because he statistically won more things than anyone else. But they don't have an affection the way they do for Garrincha.
You point out that in Brazil today, it's not unusual for a town with a population of 2,000 or 3,000 to have a stadium that seats 10,000 or 12,000, even at the expense of a public market or some other resource that would perhaps better serve the people. Why?
I think it's because to be Brazilian, you've got to express how important football is. So if you're having a little city or a little town, you've got to have a church, a town square, say a hospital, and a football pitch or a football stadium. Because it still is a country of migration and towns starting from nothing, getting really big. People think, well, we're going to be a big town. What do we need to be a big town? We need a big stadium. And they build these things. And no one thinks, what a waste of money. They think, fantastic, you know, we're proud of that. And in the same way that you can't play football on a football pitch all over Brazil, because some places it's almost desert, other places it's the jungle. So they've adapted football to suit their needs, because they need to have a football game, because it's a way of expressing the fact that they belong to Brazil. So you have in the place where they play rodeo, you have footballers that play a game of football with a bull sort of rampaging around, sort of chasing them around. In the Amazon, you have them playing on the Amazon, the mud flats, mm-hmm. and they carry on playing all the way until the water gets up to your knees. There are women who play, but what they do, they just try and keep the ball up on their feet without letting it drop. And they do this sort of several thousand times, and they've become sort of professionals at it. You know, they earn money by sort of turning up to weddings and bar mitzvahs, kicking the ball in the air, and people love it.
As entertainers, right.
As entertainers, and you would only get that in a country that values soccer so much.
You describe at some length a tournament in Brazil called the Big Kickabout, and lots of things mark this event as unusual, among them that part of the competition is a beauty contest, and that the result of the beauty contest can affect a team's chances, I gather?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's an absolutely wonderful tournament, and it happens in Manaus, which is quite a bizarre city. It's a city of about 1.5 million people, 1,500 miles up the Amazon. So it's like a sort of urban island in the middle of just jungle where very few people live. And I guess because it's so sort of isolated, it's sort of developed its own sort of cultures and ways and its own sort of crazy football tournament. And this football tournament called the Big Kickabout, anyone can enter it. The only reason why you can't enter it is if you're a professional football player. But it's so important that lots of people who are professionals try and get their professional passes revoked so they can enter. And you have about 600 teams. And the teams are great. There are sort of teams of just like 11 brothers, and there are teams of people that all work in the same company, and teams of people that have emigrated from the same little village. And they get going, and it's this massive tournament. But the best thing about it, as you say, is the fact that you're excluded from entering unless you have a beauty queen. So that there is a parallel beauty tournament to the football tournament, so that halfway through, if your team is eliminated, but your queen, the beauty queen, is, I think, a semi-finalist, then you get a bye straight back into the competition. And it has so happened that a team called Arsenal, they were knocked out, they had a very attractive queen, they went back in, and they end up winning the tournament. I mean, it's fantastic.
I think one of my favorite stories about a team in the Big Kickabout is a team in which all the players are overweight. And so, of course, their beauty queen is also overweight. That was a sort of a requirement as far as they were concerned.
Oh, absolutely. But, you know, when they were knocked out, they weren't really going to get back in again, I don't think.
When Brazil lost the World Cup final to France in 1998, investigations followed. I wonder if there's any other country in the world where losing the World Cup final would provoke congressional inquiries.
Oh, I don't think so. I mean, if England got the final of the World Cup, there would be a public holiday. But for Brazil, coming second is just terrible. It's like one guy, in fact, the guy who led a campaign to clean up Brazilian football said, being second, it's like being second in the affections of a woman. You know, you might as well be last. You've either got this first or nothing. And rather than saying, OK, we lost because we weren't as good, they were like, well, something, there was a conspiracy, because we should have won, because the world's natural order is us being the best. Therefore, we're going to have to go after what was this. And the first thing that they wanted to blame was Nike, because Nike had done this huge sponsorship deal, which was the largest sponsorship deal a clothing manufacturer had ever done with a national team. So they had this huge, big investigation in Congress there. They had two, one in the Senate and one in the House of Representatives. And in fact, what they discovered wasn't at all that Nike had done anything wrong. In fact, Nike had done very, very well for itself. It had got a really good deal. But the people that run Brazilian football had sort of siphoned away most of the money. And so you had for the last 4 years this great sort of soul-searching about what's gone wrong, you know, the rotten core of the beautiful game. And going into this current World Cup, Brazil were really down on themselves. And the fact that they came along and won it has been a great surprise. I think lots of the most people in the world said, oh, Brazil, they were always favourites. But Brazilians really weren't that confident going into the World Cup because, really, of the legacy of 1998.
At the end of the book, you write, the cliche about Brazil, that its happy football comes from childhood games played with unrestrained abandon, is false. The cliche is false. Is the spontaneity that you recognize in danger now?
Yeah, I think it is. What is not is the way Brazilians play, because it's like saying, is samba going to stop because they like listen to techno music? No, they mix it in and they do lots of other things. And they have the way Brazilians use their body, the way they dribble, the way they walk, the whole sort of way, that's not going to change. And the individual sort of ball skills, they're going to carry on kicking the ball in the air for sort of 10 hours at a time better than anyone else. And that sort of happiness and that sort of accuracy is going to continue. The problem will be the sort of the teamwork and the psychology. I mean, that could change. But I think that winning the 2002 World Cup means that at least for the next sort of 10 years, you know, Brazilians are going to be the best.
Alex Bellows is the author of Football, Soccer, the Brazilian Way, published by Bloomsbury. Alex, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, too.
Brazil, Brazil, Brazil. Brazil. Brasil, Brasil. Mas um gato chique que eu quero ver, que encha logo o cerveja no campinho. Venha ver como é forte o sucuba, quando tudo tá de pé.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston, where Only a Game is produced, and from the other NPR member stations airing this program. Additional support comes from Thermo Electron, the scientific instruments company with a mission to advance drug discovery, improve manufacturing, and protect people and the environment, on the web at thermo.com. And from Nutter, McLennan, and Fish, working to solve critical legal issues on local, national, and international levels. Information at nutter.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Margulies and Associates, combining creativity and experience in providing architectural, interior design, and project management services to corporate and institutional clients throughout New England. Margulies.com. Good morning, I'm Dolores Handy. In sports headlines, the Red Sox beat the Yankees 4-2 last night in the first game of a three-game weekend series. The win moves the Sox to within two games of the division-leading Yankees. Game two of the series at Yankee Stadium this afternoon has Rolando Araujo on the mound for Boston against his fellow Cuban best friend, Orlando El Duque Hernandez, on the mound for New York. There are about 16,000 tickets still unsold for Monday's tribute to Hall of Fame slugger Ted Williams. Some say the feud between Williams' children over what to do with his remains is in part to blame for slow sales. As of yesterday, about 17,000 tickets to the Fenway Park event had been sold. The Boston Celtics have signed 7'3" center Bruno Sundorf. The 22-year-old has played only 50 games in his four-year career, which includes stints with Indiana and Dallas. In the forecast, clouds breaking for sun today. Pleasant, highs around 78 degrees. Tonight's lows in the 60s. Tomorrow's highs around 80. Many of the books you hear about on Only a Game are available through our website. Just go to onlyagame.org and click on Public Radio Store. And remember, part of every purchase helps pay for the news on WBUR.
I'm Robert Siegel. Join me and my colleague Ann Garrows as she talks about her recent experiences reporting from Afghanistan.
They arrived here with nothing but the clothes on their back and two medical books. Uncertain of their future, they're unwilling to invest in anything more than sleeping mats and plastic plates.
For a contribution of $30, you can attend the discussion tomorrow at the Old Wailing Church on Martha's Vineyard. Proceeds help pay for the news. Log on to WBUR.org or call 1-800-909-9287.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, discourse on some dramatic disc doings. But first, joining me to discuss the sports news of the week, our analyst Charlie Pierce. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
As we wait to see whether any of the Major League Baseball currently being played will matter at all, the owners have begun snarling at each other. This week, Cleveland Indians owner Charles Dolan called Yankees owner George Steinbrenner, quote, a large part of our problem. a valid charge?
Well, it used to be that the toy commissioner, Alan H. Selig, would tell you that he was going to fine any owner $1 million if he spoke out of turn on this particular issue. The problem is, of course, that Larry Dolan is speaking the company line loudly, so that he will not be fined or disciplined in any way by the toy commissioner, Alan H. Selig. This story illustrates one thing that's remarkable to me, which is that if you ever intimate that these guys should spend their own money on their baseball team, they act like you're asking them to sell the family puppy for medical experimentation. This is Dolan's problem. What he doesn't say is George is not spending George's money. George is spending revenue that most of us don't have. Well, wait a minute. He is spending his own money.
His revenue.
He has more of it than you do.
Meanwhile, Charlie, some fans have established a website urging folks to sign a petition which will be presented to both players and owners, urging both parties to refrain from interrupting the season. Have you ever seen any evidence that either the players or the owners have ever responded to the wishes of the fans?
This would be www.completewasteoftime.com, right? No, they will not respond to this. I don't care how many signatures this particular group gets on its petitions. I don't care where they present the petitions. I don't care if they're the size of the Chrysler Building and they hang them at high noon there. This is two groups of people fighting over what is not fighting over money. That's merely the excuse. Fighting over the power to control the sport. And frankly, the fans are along for the ride with this. And if fans aren't comfortable in the role of sheep, they should not be fans.
One of the teams frequently identified as in financial trouble, the Tampa Bay Devil Rays, was apparently late in paying two former members of the team. The front office claims it was, quote, an administrative foul-up, and the team is not, in fact, out of money. I guess we'll see as the season limps along.
Well, I'm getting the very strong feeling that if the toy commissioner of baseball, Alan H. Selig, were to go to the Associated Press and tell them that baseball was in financial trouble because all of their liquid cash had been eaten by a herd of snow-white unicorns, the Associated Press would put it in the paper. This is attributed to several baseball officials telling the Associated Press. One of the players in question, a pitcher named Steve Traxel, has said it's not anybody's business. His agent says it isn't true. The owner of the team says it isn't true. The only people that say it's true are the people who have a stake in the current negotiating process that want it to be true.
Right. Several of the former minority partners in the Montreal Expos organization have sued the former Expos owner, Jeffrey Loria, who now owns the Florida Marlins, and they've sued the commissioner as well. A suit with merit?
This one is extraordinarily interesting, and as such, I think baseball will settle it quick and quietly, and this suit will unfortunately die a quick and silent death. But this is a suit brought under every prosecutor's favorite four-letter word, RICO. And it's a little bit complicated, but basically it throws into question the complicated negotiations that got Jeffrey Loria out of Montreal into the Florida Marlins and enabled John Henry, who then owned the Florida Marlins, to buy the Boston Red Sox. Mm-hmm. This could be the clear cut of baseball's economics if this suit were to go forward, and that's why I don't think it would. It is easy to attempt to dismiss this suit as having been brought by a bunch of minority partners, which gives everyone the impression that they're a bunch of little old ladies who invested $5 of the egg money in the team. You're dealing with the Bronfman family, you're dealing with investment banks, you're dealing with the elite of the Montreal economic scene. If baseball doesn't settle this quickly and quietly the way it did the suit in Minnesota, its entire internal structure and operations is open to discovery under the RICO statute.
And the basic charge here is the fix was in. It was not a fair process deciding who would get to own what teams.
Well, that's the second level of the suit. The suit basically says that Loria conspired to destroy the Montreal Expos for the purposes of moving them probably to Northern Virginia, but especially in order so that that would be the way he would demonstrate his bona fides to the people who run baseball, so he would then be allowed to buy the Florida Marlins, thereby enabling John Henry to buy the Boston Red Sox.
I don't know how well Tiger Woods ultimately will do at the British Open, which still has today and tomorrow to run, but he got off to a very inauspicious start at Muir Field when a security guard failed to recognize him and wouldn't let him onto the practice tee before the first round. She was perhaps not the right security guard for the job?
But she is a remarkable person, since she's probably the only person in the world who doesn't recognize Tiger Woods. There were always people saying that, you know, no matter how famous you are, there's somewhere out there somebody who doesn't know who you are. Clearly, Tiger has found his one person.
He found her. I don't know how they managed to do it and get her in the right place at the right time. One story this week was headlined, Armstrong Streak Ends, but the Tour de France still has a couple of weeks and several mountains to go, so I'm not sure what that meant, especially since Mr. Armstrong shortly thereafter took the lead in the race. That was on Thursday. So, a four-peat?
I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, he's not racing as well as he has in the past. What happened was they have these wonderful little races within the race of the Tour de France, which makes it very confusing to the average American sports fan who believes that a race begins here and ends there, and the first person that gets there from here first wins. But they have these time trials within the body of the race, and Lance Armstrong had won five long-distance time trials in a row since 1999. This week he lost to a Colombian named Santiago Botero. But as you say, he is ahead now in the race. So he is now in that stretch of the race where he generally takes command. So I suspect this will be a little bit harder for him this time around, but we will see another victory.
Finally, a salute, Charlie, and only a game salute to Ted Byram. At the age of 82, 17 days after suffering a partial stroke, Mr. Byram bowled a 300 game.
And good for him, and we can only hope that down there in Florida, Mr. Byram doesn't have an unemployable grown son who needs money.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Globe Sunday magazine as well as Esquire magazine, and he lends his opinions to Only a Game as well. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
It is said to have begun with a pie plate. After somebody ate the pie out of it, that somebody discovered that with a flick of the wrist, the plate could be made to sail through the air towards somebody else. From that humble, perhaps apocryphal beginning, all manner of derivatives have sprung and dipped and skidded and sailed, as Only a Game's Karen Given now reports.
Last Sunday afternoon, in bright sunshine and light winds, 60 competitors and about twice as many spectators gathered on Boston's Esplanade, a linear park on the Charles River, for one of the world's most unusual world championships.
Ah, yes. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, dogs and cats, please put your hands together for our next team.
These competitors have come to crown the world's best at freestyle frisbee, a competition so odd that tournament directors Petri Isola and Alan Kaplan get nervous when I ask them to explain it.
Well, you're going to go. You want me to explain it?
Yeah.
Okay. This is where we get into the eye of the beholder type of thing, okay? But it's characterized, I would say, by trick catches, trick throws with a disc. Also, there's the ability to spin the disc on the finger and a number of tricks in putting that all together. It's not quite like anything else out there.
Think about Harlem Globetrotters, but with a frisbee.
Freestyle frisbee also has a lot in common with ice skating. Teams of competitors, often in costume, perform to music. Judges rate them on execution, artistic impression, and difficulty. Otherwise, there don't seem to be many rules. There are no required moves and apparently no limit to the number of frisbees a team can use during a routine. All this freedom has spawned a long and growing list of tricks. Randy Silvey, a competitor from Seattle, Washington, runs through a few of his favorites.
There's like the flaw, there's the flamingo, there's the gaitosis, the gaitis, the scarecrow, the flare, the indigenous. I'm trying to think, I mean, they just go on and on. The China syndrome is one. That's where you commit your whole body and you throw your legs up in the air. So what you're going to do is land on your head. So it's, kind of a commitment move. And you just got to catch it while it's up there, and it's a crash and burn move.
Just because someone knows the name of a trick doesn't mean he can perform it or even explain it. Take the move bearing everyone's favorite name, the alien birth ritual.
I never quite knew what that was, but you got to talk to one of the legends around here.
You're asking the wrong person. That's not my style. I don't do that.
Hey, you got to talk to a guy named Skippy Jammer, the guy who invented it.
It's kind of hard to explain. It's a move where you put it up in an angle and you get it, you restrict it behind your leg, and you move your back around, and then you pull it back through around to your front side. And there's no way to describe it without it being a visual. thing.
Well, with that explanation out of the way, let the competition continue. Cindy Krueger from Seattle, Washington, and Paul Kenny from Jacksonville Beach, Florida, take to the field for their four-minute-long routine. Kenny's been competing for 5 or 6 years, making him a newbie by freestyle standards. But according to his fellow competitors, Kenny's signature throws with multiple frisbees have already made him a legend. Kenny takes his sport seriously. Over the past few months, he even grew out his hair and his beard to complement his hippie tie-dye costume.
It's my form of Zen exercise. It's exercise. It's that there's like a spiritual thing. You know, we'll get the boombox, you get that music, and you're physically just in the moment, and nothing else matters. You know, it's just very harmonic, if you will, so to speak. So.
Four-legged athletes have their place at this event, too. Frisbee-catching dogs and their trainers are on hand to keep the crowd entertained during lags in the competition. Some of the biggest cheers of the afternoon go to the dogs, much to the aggravation of the human element, like veteran competitor Larry Imperiale.
You know, that's our worst thing. Oh, are there dogs? You know, and we practice, and it's just so hard for us. And then you get a dog and you give him some water and a frisbee when he's a puppy, and then he's a great frisbee dog, and people love him because they're so cute.
From Jacksonville, Florida, Paul Kenny and Dan Yarnell.
Paul Kenny is from Jacksonville, and Dan Yarnell is also from Jacksonville. These guys, very interesting.
As the open pairs final gets underway, Randy Sylvie agrees to talk me through a routine.
And Paul is now going into like a tip sequence. He calls it the machine gun. So it's just, he's just going really fast, tipping it under his leg. Pop, pop, pop. And you can hear the music going, oh my God, he's hitting it. And there he goes, and he gets his catch. Right to the tune, too. Well done, Polly.
But midway through the routine, Kenny and Yarnell run into a few problems.
Execution. So Paul just dropped another one there, and he gets a .3 deduction from a score of 10. So you want to keep your execution score in the 9. So that means three drops is going to be .3, .3, .3. So that'd be a 9-1. And that's where the winning routines, and see, they're really struggling here all of a sudden.
Kenny and Yarnell offer up one of the more difficult routines of the afternoon, with Kenny catching 6 discs in one hand for the big finale. But along the way, more than a few discs have hit the ground, and the team ends up with a third-place finish. Sylvie says upsets like this aren't uncommon in freestyle frisbee.
The execution is one of the wild cards, because you never know when a gust of wind is going to come, and that can just be a nightmare for any of the players, because it takes you out of your rhythm. You're trying to figure where you are in your routine. You don't have to worry about that in ice skating, you know, gust of wind knocking you down.
Meanwhile, on the west side of the field, sitting under the shade of a few scraggly trees, Larry Imperiale, that resenter of dogs, waits for his turn in the open pairs final. He's from Evergreen, Colorado, and he's no newcomer to stiff international competition.
We often go to Italy. I played in Slovakia. Last year I was at the World Games in Japan. Tournaments in Finland and Helsinki. And
how well do you do?
Generally pretty well.
Really well.
I've won 10 world championships. I've won tournaments in 4 decades. Don't say that on the radio. And I've even climbed a mountain in Nepal and done some frisbee tricks at over 20,000 feet.
Imperiale says freestyle frisbee is great for old guys, as he calls himself, because it takes so long to get good. But what's the real secret to Imperiale's success? He almost never practices.
Me personally, I probably play 3 times a week, but it's not practice. We call it jamming. And the worst thing is to have to go practice your routine. It's much more fun to go out there and be spontaneous.
Freestyle frisbee competitors, even successful ones like Imperiale, don't get recognized on the street. Most don't have sponsors, and the ones who do find that the money doesn't even cover travel expenses. And the cash prizes awarded at some tournaments don't go very far either. So why do they do it?
The second the last pair plays in the open pairs finals, you'll see every single competitor run out and start playing in what we call mob ops, where groups of 5 or 6 will start playing, trying to do spontaneous moves, and that's what I live for, that
last throw of the last routine. I just can't wait, and I just run out there, and we just all start playing together. And that's what brings me the most satisfaction in the sport. It's all about fun, because isn't that what life's all about?
From the start of Imperiali and his partner Joel Rogers' routine, it's clear the pair is having fun. And before long, it becomes clear that having fun is a pretty good way to win a world championship. While Larry Imperiali waits to hear that he's won his 11th world championship, he takes to the field for jam time. And believe it or not, he really doesn't seem to care whether or not he's won. For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given in Boston, Massachusetts.
Please welcome to the field.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is Tad Curry. We had help this week from Manoli Wetherill at NPR's New York Bureau and Randy Johnson at Minnesota Public Radio. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a tape of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287. Sets are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to hear our program again, see photos from the World Freestyle Frisbee Championships, or sign up for our newsletter, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. In our final word this week, freestyle frisbee champ Larry Imperiali explains why dogs are better at his favorite sport.
They don't care if they drop it. It's like, okay, whatever. And we're like, oh, darn, we dropped it.
A pretty gracious statement for a guy upstaged by a four-legged athlete. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants, educating discerning patients and dentists since 1985 about their options for the replacement of missing and compromised teeth. Information online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is WBUR.